Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of not only the books that I have authored, but some articles that I have written that you might be interested in and tell you how to access them. In my broadcast, some of you have noticed that you hear very little about financial support, and that's deliberate. We really trust God here on that score and firmly believe that God pays for what He orders. The same policy is true in my local church ministry. Other than the teaching we offer on these broadcasts, over the years I have done a good deal of writing, as time allows, to prepare resources that I think should be helpful to my congregation and also helpful to you, our listeners. But on this program, I don't say a lot about those resources, much as I don't say a lot about finances, and I guess that omission in terms of resources kind of defeats the purpose. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the books I have authored. One of them co-authored with my daughter, The Finality of Jesus Christ. It's a very important book, and if anybody will let the Scriptures answer their questions about whether there are many ways to God, this will be decisive. Another very important book I've written is Polishing God's Monuments, Pillars of Hope for Punishing Times. I've written a book on marriage. Should help a lot of people if both are serious about walking with God in their marriage. Marriage Without Remorse, Rules for the Road. And finally, one about the pastoral ministry would be good for elders and leaders, too. Dispatches from the Front Lines, Reflections on the Glory and Grind of Pastoral Ministry. On top of that, on the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, one of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the Scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice after all. That has all been a misunderstanding. Well, there will be others, but I mentioned those three. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. So I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. Now, back to our current study. We continue our exposition of the prophet Isaiah. We're in Isaiah chapter 5. Verse 8, where the prophet begins a catalog of ugly specifics under the heading of six woes that have begged for retribution, and to those woes he annexes examples of appropriate consequences God has in store as punishment. This litany of woes is just a sample of their wickedness. I've said again and again and again, you've always got to say it so we connect the dots, that the things God hated yesterday, He hates today and He hates tomorrow, and from those we can all draw lessons appropriate to us and our contemporaries. The first woe in verse 8 has to do with rapacity, covetousness, their avaricious ways. The second woe is in verses 11 through 12. Woe to those who rise up early in the morning, that they may pursue strong drink. They stay up late in the evening, that wine may inflame them, and their banquets are accompanied by harp and lyre, by tambourine and flute, and by wine, of course. A full orchestra, in other words. But they do not pay attention to the deeds of the Lord, nor do they consider the work of His hands. Here there is a picture of intemperate excess, and lives given over, as we said in our last study, to bands and Bacchus, mirth and drunkenness of the order of the day. They are in the main a bunch of party people, letting it out and living it up. This is so modern, so Western world, so American. Here the storm clouds are gathering, and we're still cavorting around like tourists with half a brain, braving out a hurricane. Well, Isaiah tells Judah and Israel that God has had it with this excess and ingratitude. His extreme patience has worn extremely thin. Now the time has come to face the music of another kind, the consequences of their wickedness. Here they are, kicking up their heels, partying when they should be praying, in mirth when they should be in mourning, amusing themselves when they should be abasing themselves before God. Now the time has come, and the Lord's about to get their attention by a heavier hand. Therefore my people will go into exile for their lack of knowledge. Their honorable men are famished, their multitude is parched with thirst, he foresees. Therefore, Sheol, a name for the abode of the souls of the dead, it's envisioned as a great beast. It has enlarged its throat and opened its mouth without measure. Jerusalem, splendor, her multitude, her den of revelry, and the jubilant within her, well, it's all going to descend into the pit. The prophet foretells the exile, meaning the Babylonian exile, when the Babylonians will invade Judah, overthrow and destroy Jerusalem and the temple, and will exappropriate all but the poorest of the populace way off to Babylon. Nobody sees the works of God in any of this stuff. Just make sure, my friends, that you're on the right side of history, and that is where you will be if you're on the side of Christ and walking in alignment with Him. What was then correlates very closely to what exists today. This is a very good time, my friends, to get serious, not silly. This would be a very good time to seek after God, not the good life. This would be a very good time to clean up our act rather than follow the crowd. A very good time to give ourselves over completely to Christ and not to the culture. This would be a very good time, America, and our corrupt churches, to come out from among them and to be separate, not keep jumping in among them, and at last be savaged by the indignation of a holy God. Folks, it's time for us to quit playing around and to start praying without ceasing. It's time to stop worrying about our stocks in the market and start thinking about our stock in heaven, where our treasures do not waste away nor suffer loss. So in review, let's remind ourselves that God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Once again, what He deplored in human manners and morals in ancient times, the times of Isaiah, the times of Jeremiah, He still deplores in modern times. What God punished then, He still punishes, if people will not repent and persist in their perversity and their rebellion against God. My friends, as a nation and as individuals, this constitutional principle of God's universe never fails. We reap what we sow. So again, my exhortation to all of us is, let us walk humbly and circumspectly before our holy God. Let us not presume upon God's mercy and grace. Let us not cavort in sin and ignore His will and live to please ourselves rather than to please Him. Listen, the worst message a nation or an individual can send to heaven is, God, I don't take You seriously. I don't trust You. I don't trust Your principles or Your promises. I don't trust Your ways. I don't think You're living up to Your billing. I don't think You're as advertised, so I will just do my own thing. That's where Israel was. That's where Judah was. That's where we are today. And Judah and Israel are still paying that price to this day. Listen, God's judgment will come without respect of persons, the prophet now declares in verses 15 through 17. So Isaiah says, here's the deal. The common man will be humbled and the man of importance abased. The eyes of the proud will also be abased. But the Lord of hosts will be exalted in judgment, and the holy God will show Himself holy in righteousness. Then The lambs will graze as in their pasture, and strangers or lambs will eat in the waste places of the wealthy. Here's an expression of what has been called the design and ultimate effect of God's punishment of corrupt Judah. Judah, like so many in our churches today, was just a place where God's people were his people in name only. God's judgment's going to show up in the abasement of the proud man and the exaltation of the Lord, or Yahweh, whom they had rejected. The sense here is this. Let a man be ever so high, God's judgment will bring him down. Let him be ever so little, God's judgment will bring him even lower. That's a paraphrase of Matthew Henry. Again, I remind you, this expression, the Lord of hosts, is a description of Yahweh, or the Lord, as the sovereign of all forces, literally all armies. Those forces may be animate or inanimate. They may be earthly or they may be heavenly. Whatever they are or all together, he brings them to bear on any given situation as he pleases and as he needs them. And because of these forces, which a sovereign God controls, he cannot be thwarted in his actions. When the Lord of hosts sets punishment in motion, Isaiah is saying his justice will magnify his character, and his righteousness will broadcast his holiness or his moral purity as he holds evildoers accountable for their actions. The consequence will be a scene from riches to ruins, where once homes occupied by rich fat cat landowners, surrounded by cultivated fields and manicured places, by God's judicial action are turned into waste places and denuded of their owners. Isaiah in his vision sees estates standing vacant and destroyed or deteriorating and their grounds unkempt. He sees their once flourishing crops no longer cultivated. What's there now are just fallow fields that serve as feeding grounds for sheep. Their once fine homes are taken over by total strangers. We might say Isaiah sees them becoming the haunts of street people or strangers hanging out in their ruins. Now, folks, right here is a question to ponder. Nobody, I imagine, has any difficulty seeing how displays of God's mercy and grace glorify or exalt his name. But you notice something here. Isaiah trumpets this fact, but the Lord of hosts will be exalted in judgment. I repeat. But the Lord of hosts will be exalted in judgment, and the holy God will show himself holy in righteousness. How does judgment, not just deliverance or salvation, but how does judgment glorify God? Well, you see, in judgment, in his just judgment, God displays his holiness. By that I mean he displays his moral purity, his moral otherness or transcendence. He displays his absolute righteousness and his unflinching justice. You see, if sin is not purged by God's forgiveness, if we are not justified by faith, it will have to be purged by his holiness. If sin is not cleansed, God's justice will find it and deal with it root and limb. The unrepentant wicked, is that you, will pay the price. If you don't know God, you don't know God if you don't know Christ. If you've rejected Christ, if you haven't received him, you've rejected him, then you are the wicked, and you will pay the price. And when God judges you, God will be glorified in that judgment. And you'll pay the price every time and to the dime. At the end of the day, God will square all the books. Folks, that's why I personally am not depressed, nor should you be. When we read this litany of judgments that will flow and befall the wicked, this litany of judgments that will come upon the faithless and the rebellious, you and I should rather rejoice and exult. Not that we want to see people swept away by flood tide of God's wrath and judgment, but when people just steadfastly rebel against God, poke him in the eye, so to speak, I rejoice that this gracious God is also a holy God, that he's one who abhors wickedness. I rejoice that in justice he will, in his time, punish the wicked who flatly reject his grace. I rejoice that God is one day going to eradicate evil from the face of the earth. That exalts him. That God, that holy God, That just God is magnified in my eyes and should be in yours, and in the eyes of all who love what is good and despise what is evil. He should be magnified in his holiness. Now comes the third woe, verses 18 and 19. Woe to those who drag iniquity with cords of falsehood and sin as if with cart ropes. Woe to those who say, let God make speed, let him hasten his work, that we may see it. And they say, let the purpose of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come to pass, that we may know it. Embedded in this woe is a sort of moral law that we see in Romans 1, 24 and 26. Here's the idea. Sin drags in its wake its own punishments in the form of more sins. For sin by its very nature is not merely dishonoring to God, but it is self and socially destructive as well. In other words, human sin brings its own whips to flagellate its practitioners. That's a law of life. So, this third woe is pronounced upon those who in their rebelliousness against God drag iniquity behind them with cords and ropes of falsehood. They are liars and deceivers, and by means of their falseness, they pull heavy loads of sin behind them wherever they go. You see, sin follows liars and cheats and deceivers, like carts being drawn by mules. The picture here in this woe in 18 through 19 is one of people generating iniquity on purpose and with perspiration. They work at it. They work at sin, and it works them. And the implication is that sin creates more sin, requiring greater energy and exertion to cope with the bad loads, the heavy loads that it generates. These people are not only aggressive, presumptuous transgressors that Isaiah sees, but cynical, mocking rebels who smirk at prophetic denunciations of their activities, smirk at people who call them out, and warnings of disaster come as a result of their disregard of God's reproof. Well, they say, if God's all in a twist about our sins, then let him show up and do something about it. Put up or shut up is the spirit of their challenge to the Holy One of Israel. And what we have here in Isaiah's sights is scorn and defiance of God, and it hasn't gone away. It has continued not only in Israel and Judea, but in all nations of the world since that time, and is going on today, and it's going to meet with the same judgment. How many out there take seriously the threat of the judgment of God? Not many. People are bolder and bolder these days in their iniquity. When one would try to check them by invoking the specter of divine judgment, typically they get angry or shrill or react scornfully, dumping hot lava all over you. Oh, sure, sure, yeah, God's going to drop a bomb on me. Ain't never seen him do anything yet about anything. Hey, if he's there, it'd really be nice if sometime he came out and made his presence known, don't you think? So until he shows me he's more than a paper tagger, I just think I'll keep on doing whatever I want. That's pretty much the attitude. When an individual or a culture gets in this state of godlessness, when they get so far removed from any personal reference to divine revelation as the compass for their actions, I want to tell you something, people. It's not long until moral relativism takes over. From there, individuals and societies lapse into a habit of moral inversion, where morality gets all turned on its head. And that's what the prophet next decries in verse 20. And boy, do we see it in our day as well. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil. Woe to those who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. My, my, my. That is exactly the moral climate in the Western world and in America today. And more it leaks over into the churches. Marriage used to be considered a good thing, a noble thing, a great thing. Today, with many in our culture, it's actually considered a bad thing. Living together out of wedlock was once considered a scandal. Today, it is considered good by a shocking number. Today, those who are champions of a clean and safe moral environment are mocked and maligned as self-righteous prudes. They're evil. They're Nazis. They're fascist. What's the new righteousness? Oh, It's taking up the cause of the physical environment and saving the planet and the snails. That's the new good, capital N, capital G. You want to stop moral pollution? Oh, that's bad. You're trying to stop air pollution? Oh, that's good. We Christians and the world about us have two vastly different notions of environmental pollution. This world strains at gnats and it swallows camels. The things they fret about might do some damage long term to our temporal bodies, but the things God warns us about will destroy our very souls. And then there's the practice of homosexuality, as well as fornication and infidelity. Generally, homosexuality and these others have been historically regarded as deviant behavior. But now we're all enlightened. I don't know whether you'd heard, but the media, the politicians, and the school systems are approving it, if not actually, in many cases, promoting it. In the world of entertainment, things are so twisted nowadays that a little scandal actually promotes a career. But I think you all know being a straight arrow is a box office killer. In our area, especially in the metro area, in this very, very, very deeply blue state, a woman can abort an unborn child, and few people will notice, and very few will give a hoot. But if that same woman were to walk out and cut down a big tree here in Lake Oswego, Oregon, where our church is located, the whole community would demonize her, and doubtless the police would be all over her like Harold and Nate. You'd think she was a serial murderer. Some these days are so bold as to actually say, greed is good. I've heard that a few times from talking heads on TV. It used to be that being a moral person was a high tribute. Today, the word moral itself is a bit tainted with self-righteousness. For example, how many people at the office look forward to the appearance of a highly moral fellow employee? All he or she does is chill the soup. Instead of being a big plus and a welcome sign being put out, they're regarded as being a big dip. Well, all of that, ancient and modern, God did judge, and he's going to judge again. Woe be to those who contribute to this moral vertigo. This moral upside-downness is a symptom of sin out of control. A society given to excess, a secular space where the revelation of God is denied access to the public square. When a people is in the dark, the whole society falls into a moral and ethical ditch. Now the taproot of all this is human arrogance, and here comes the fifth woe. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. Here Isaiah is talking about people who in their own conceit imagine that they are intelligent enough to manage life without God, and to find their way without the compass of revelation. It's the who needs God attitude. God hates human arrogance that despises his command and ignores his will in the confidence of self-sufficiency. Such people, let it be known, are in the crosshairs of the indignation of a holy God. One day they will pay dearly for their arrogance. Isaiah 29:14 says, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will set aside. You see, to be saved, one must humble oneself before God, otherwise one will miss the train, so to speak. People who are wise in their own eyes may appear to be gaining the whole world, but if in the end they lose their own souls, they've lost everything, gained nothing. Jesus said, what does it benefit to gain the whole world and lose your own soul? In his judgment, the Lord does not have to run them down with a smart bomb of temporal disaster. Really, the worst calamity that could befall people happens when God does nothing at all, but allows their self-sufficient arrogance to cause them to despise the gospel and reject the way of salvation. Thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.